man, woman, child, old, young, very learned, not so learned, you know. It doesn't matter, any of these things, a big degree or no degree. All of these things are external. The execution of devotional service simply requires that firm faith, that shraddha. Now, the nine yogendras, who are the ones giving these instructions in this chapter, they take things a step further. They note that it's not enough just to have faith. Okay, you got that part down. You got faith, all right? Great, okay. I believe in devotional service. But that's not enough. Why do I believe in devotional service? Because my scriptures tell me. Srimad Bhagavatam says so. Bhagavad Gita says so. Okay. But the yogendras go a step further in this verse. They say, now you should also not blaspheme other scriptures. Sometimes we see that, well, let's be honest, not all scriptures are created equally, as they said. Some have a greater detail of learning and an expanded field of information than others do. Srimad Bhagavatam is described as the cream of the Vedas. It's the topmost source of knowledge. So, you know, some scriptures may not have all of that information. But there are scriptures that directly describe the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and then there are scriptures that indirectly describe the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should not blaspheme one over the other. Oh, I accept the Srimad Bhagavatam. Everything else is just nonsense, useless news. No, some respect must be there. Now, there are other practitioners in other paths that have respect for those scriptures, and they value those scriptures. Therefore, we should respect that. They may describe the Supreme Personality of Godhead in a more indirect way, but they should also be respected. This is the point that the yogendras are making here. Such type of tolerant respect has a side benefit. That side benefit is the development of humility. Now here again, humility is one of the key essential factors in the development of our devotional service. Humility is one of those things that we constantly strive for. It doesn't matter if one is a brand new devotee or a very learned devotee or has been a devotee for years or a perfected devotee, the quality of humility is essential. Now, if one happens to go around thinking, you know, I've actually got it. I understand it. My scripture tells everything and nobody else does. This will not create a mood of humility in the aspiring devotee. One must show respect to all others and expect no respect for themselves. Show respect to others and expect no respect for themselves. Let me ask the students in the Bhaktivedanta Academy, does that sound like something you might have heard, some famous person might have written that? Anybody have an idea? Yes, and what would that verse be, do you know? Yes, you know which verse of the Shikshastakam it is? Who knows? You know the first word of that verse? Trinadapi, I bet you all know that verse, right? Let me hear it. Yes, very good. Respect others and don't expect any respect in return. This is what the nine yogendras are telling us, and this was Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is our immediate representative, our acharya in this path of understanding devotional service, has passed that information down to all the spiritual masters, and Srila Prabhupada has given that to us. Now, the next part of this verse gets really hard. Are you ready? Just like sometimes you teach, you'll say, okay, that was an easy test. The rest of the test is going to be really hard. So the rest of this verse becomes really hard because the sages state that we should rigidly control the mind, the speech, and the bodily activities, always speak the truth, and bring the mind and senses under full control. Show of hands, who has that process down very solid? You've all developed humility. Now, one who has the mind under control, really? Never deviating? The mind is perfectly fixed 24 hours a day on the lotus feet of Krishna? Any of us? No, I don't think so. How about somebody who has their speech controlled and never talks anything that's not Krishna conscious? Yeah. Or how about somebody that's got their body completely under control? No nonsense activities. Or how about this one? Always speaks the truth. Did you take that glove from me? No, I didn't take that glove from you. And finally, always has the mind and senses under control. Now, in this section, the sages, they point out information that as we're progressing in devotional service should almost make us hang our heads in shame, knowing that we're not at that point. That this is what's expected, but that we're not there. Now, if by some chance you happen to think, yeah, I got those down. I'm good at that. I got my mind under control. I control my speech. Well, there's two words used in this translation I would like to bring to our attention. Rigidly and full control. Now, that's a very tall order. Rigidly. As it's described about the vows that Raghunath Das Goswami executed, they were like lines in a stone. If you have a line etched into a piece of rock, it doesn't ever change. It never alters. Just like that. So, rigidly, are we controlling our mind, our senses, our words, our activities? And are we fully controlling them? So even if we think, yeah, I've got it down, then we look at these two words and we realize, no, none of us are there yet. And yes, I said it, none of us. We're all struggling and hoping and desiring to achieve that. So what hope is there for us? What hope is there for us to execute devotional service? Now, we don't want to discourage anybody. That's not what this class is about. You know, that's not the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam, to make everyone feel discouraged. And neither is it the purpose of Rupa Goswami. So he states, again, we get this from the Nectar Devotion, Ihai asya haryadasya karmana manasa gira nikilashyapi avashto jivan mukta sayuchate. A person acting in Krishna consciousness, that's all of us sitting here, in the service of Krishna, in the service of Radha Shyam Sunda, with their mind, body, intelligence, and words, alright, you're ready for it, here it comes, is a liberated person. So there's hope for us. If we're executing devotional service, we're a liberated person. Even though we may be in the material world, and even though we may be engaged in so-called material activities. So there's hope for us if we act with a little bit of effort under the instructions of who? Students in the Bhaktivedanta Academy? Who do we act under the instructions of? Yes? Yes. The teacher, the guru, the spiritual master. Same personality. This is who we act under the instructions of. By doing that, by engaging our mind, body, intelligence, and words under the instruction of the spiritual master, we are a liberated person, even though we may appear to be in the material world performing material activities. We've got a little protection zone, right? Just like if the knights in old times would go out to do battle, they would put on all kinds of armor, and chainmail, and helmets, you know, because you get this big, huge lance coming at you, and you don't want it to, so you have to protect yourself. Or maybe a little bit more, if you're going out into the outside, you're going to put mosquito repellent on to protect yourself. So here is that same kind of bubble to protect ourselves when we're executing our devotional service. Now, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur mentions in this purport, or is quoted in this purport, that one cannot develop the godly qualities mentioned in these verses unless one accepts the shelter at the lotus feet of a bona fide spiritual master. Tasmat gurum prapadyeta jignasu shreya upanam. So one who performs worship, Bhaktisiddhanta continues, one who performs the worship of Lord Govinda, Lord Shyam Sundar, but fails to worship his devotees, is to be understood not to be a devotee, but simply a victim of false pride. This means that you have to respect each other, that we have to be appreciative of our God brothers, of our God sisters. For those who have accepted the shelter at the lotus feet of a pure devotee of Krishna, it is very easy to execute devotional service and progress on the path. If we are doing devotional service and serving the deities, either by doing kirtan or directly serving the deities and making garlands, whatever it is, doing our studies, that's service to the deities. Doing your studies, you become a good student, you become a good devotee, that's service to the deities. But if we're doing that and we don't respect the other Vaishnavas, we don't show appreciation to them, we're just fooling ourselves. What does it say here? We're a victim of false pride. And false pride will not get us back home, back to Godhead. Now, speaking of spiritual masters, today is the appearance day of Madhvacharya, one of the most prominent spiritual masters in our history. Now, he quotes in this same purport here from the Brahmananda Purana, one should have complete faith in the transcendental literature such as Srimad Bhagavatam and other literatures that glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should also have faith in the Vaishnava Tantras, the original Vedas, the Mahabharata, which includes the Bhagavad Gita and is considered to be the fifth Veda. Wait a minute. It's the fifth Veda. So that means there's four preceding Vedas. Raising your hands one at a time, which of the Bhaktivedanta Academy students can give me the names of the other four Vedas? One. Huh? No, we're looking for the four Vedas. One of them. Rig Veda's one. Yes? Sama Veda's two. Back around and come on. Yes. Yajur Veda's three. Last one? Yes. Atharva Veda. These are the four Vedas. Rig, Sama, Artha, Yajur. Atharva and Yajur. These are the four Vedas, and the Mahabharata, which includes the Bhagavad Gita, is considered to be the fifth Veda. So Madhvacharya says that we should have faith in these. And why should we have faith in them? Because the Vedic knowledge emanates from the breathing of Lord Vishnu. The breathing of Lord Vishnu. Which student can tell me which incarnation breathed the Vedas? Come on. Really? Yes. Which incarnation of Vishnu breathed the Vedas? Hayagriva. During the creation, the demons Madhu and Kaitab, this is that famous song, Vibharisesha, the Prabhupada sings so wonderfully. It's my favorite Prabhupada bhajan. Madhu and Kaitab stole the Vedas from Lord Brahma, and Vishnu in the form of Hayagriva came back and retrieved them. So these Vedic literatures were then compiled for us in this day and age by Srila Vyasadeva, also an incarnation of Vishnu. Therefore, Lord Vishnu himself is considered to be the speaker of these original Vedas. Now, just a few notes on Madhvacharya. In Madhvacharya's childhood, his name was Vasudev. Just like we all have a name in our childhood, then we take initiation or, you know, progress on like that, we get another name. So it's said that one time his father piled up a lot of debts. Some of you may have this experience that due to raising a family and business activities, the father may accumulate some debts. So Madhvacharya didn't like the fact that his father had debts. So he took some tamarind seeds. Everybody knows what tamarind is? Sometimes you've seen in the pujari room that big bucket of brown water. You know this one. That big bucket of brown water, that's tamarind water. And you soak copper in there and it becomes spotlessly shiny. You don't have to use any polish or anything. So he took tamarind seeds and put them in the palm of his hand and squeezed them until they turned to gold coins. And then he gave those to his father to pay his debts off. Where was my son when I needed him? All right. When he was 5 years old, he received his Upanaya, his sacred thread. And there was a demon, Manimam, in the form of a snake that lived near his house. It was causing great havoc. It wasn't just like, you know, sometimes you get these garden snakes, these black snakes or the rat snakes. These aren't bad snakes around the house. No, this is like, you know, big demon snake. And he killed that demon snake when he was 5 years old. How did he kill it? With the toe of his left foot. Five-year-old boy. Which of you five-year-old boys is even going to put your toe near a snake? But to speak of, kill a big demon snake with it. Now, sometimes his mother would be very much in anxiety if he wasn't there. Any of you boys and girls experience that? Your mom can't find you. She's like real anxiety. She starts calling name out, you know? No matter where Madhvacharya was, in one jump, he'd be by his mother's side. No matter where it was, one jump. Now, this is an amazing thing. As a child, he was an incredible scholar. And even though his father did not agree with it, at the age of 12, he took sannyas. How many 12-year-olds in the room? Boys. 12-year-old boys? 13? Like that? 11? Two. You planning on taking sannyas this year? No? No sannyas this year? So this was Madhvacharya. Now once Madhvacharya was sitting on the bank of the sea and he was meditating very deeply on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he happened to open his eyes and he saw there was a boat coming up the coast and there was a sandbar and the boat was about to get stuck on the sandbar. So by waving his chatter in certain ways, he was able to direct the boat away. The boat made a proper landing. And the boatman came to him. This boatman was from Dwarka, and his boat was filled with all types of goods to take to market and make his money. So the boatman came to him. He said, oh, thank you so much for saving me. If I'd have been stuck, then everything would have been lost, you know. Let me give you a present. And he said, no, I'm sannyasi. What are you? I don't need a present. No, please, you must let me give you something. All right, what do you have? Oh, you have that big chunk of Gopi Chandan. Big chunk. In boats, you need a big stone or water they use now to work as a ballast to keep the boat steady. So he said, I'll take that Gopi Chandan. Lots of tealock. Lifetime supply of tealock. Never have to buy another piece of tealock from Roy Bazaar. So they brought the tealock out. And when they set it down, it broke open. And what do you think was inside the tealock? Yes, beautiful deity of Rupi Krishna. Everyone was very, very satisfied. Now, in his hand, little lump of Krishna, some sweets. So they were going to remove the deity and take him to the temple. 30 men tried to lift this deity and couldn't do it. Madhvacharya said, pick him up and carry him out. So personally brought the deity all the way to Rupi. Now, Bhaktivedanta Academy students, Madhvacharya had three activities he very much enjoyed. Who can name them one by one? No? Nobody? Mountain climbing, wrestling, and swimming. He was expert at all three of these and enjoyed these very much, and his disciples engaged in these with him. Mountain climbing, wrestling, and swimming. There you go. Okay, back to our verse. A little bit of Madhvacharya there. So, now, a little bit later in the purport, there's a very, very important instruction to us. One should avoid prajalpa. Prajalpa means whimsical conversation unrelated to devotional service. Merely restraining the senses artificially without chanting and hearing the glories of the Supreme Lord cannot be considered spiritual perfection. Sometimes you see people in India, they perform manavrat. They stand there, they don't speak. Sit there, whatever, they never speak. Prabhupada mentions, but they're very busy writing on a piece of paper. Here, give me some sweets. Here, bring me some water. So, but that type of activity alone will not give one spiritual perfection. We have a nature to talk. I'm sure the Bhaktivedanta Academy teachers can confirm that the students have a very strong nature to talk. Is that correct? Yes, yes. But we have to use our talking properly. Now, our vocal cords are one of the best gifts we have. Our vocal cords are really a wonderful gift. And we can engage them different types of devotional service. There are three particular ways that we can engage our vocal cords. Bhaktivedanta Academy students, give them to me. One, what's that? Chant. What kind of chanting? Kirtan Jap. Kirtan, okay. Chanting kirtan. Japa, chanting japa. And the third one? Glorifying the Lord, talking about his pastimes. So kirtan, japa, and katha, lila katha. These three things are the best use we can make of our vocal cords. Because these three things will enhance our Krishna consciousness and help us to remember the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is how a sincere devotee engages their vocal cords. But there's a problem. We have a strong tendency to use our vocal cords in so many other ways. Third canto describes these other ways. They're called Gramyakata. Gramyakata, this means the talk of the village. Oh, they got that, he's got that, she went there, he's doing that. They bought that, I want this, did you see that? It's called Gramyakata. Lord Chaitanya advised his disciples, Gramyakata na kahibe. Don't speak that topic that describes society, village, and neighborhood. Na, this word na means no, don't, avoid it. Now the Srimad Bhagavatam also has another phrase in that same third canto. Kukata matigni. Kukata matigni. Kukata means bad words. Kata, of course, means words. Ku means bad. Bad words. And that doesn't necessarily just mean bad language, like foul words, like dirty words. But it means words that are bad for our development spiritually. And what do? Matigni. They kill the intelligence. So when we allow ourselves to talk all this other stuff, we're killing that natural intelligence that we have willingly. So we have to be very careful like that. Now, the example is given in the purport here again, that there are certain types of domestic animals that are kept in barns, you know, in farm situations, and they're forced to be celibate. You know, they're kept isolated, so much like bulls, you know. You don't want the bulls to impregnate any of the cows, so you keep the bulls separate. Does this mean the bulls are brahmachari? No. It's simply some external circumstance that's been forced upon them. So in the same way, we can't consider ourselves spiritually advanced simply because we have the ability to argue on different speculative subjects, perform some types of austerities. These things alone will not bring about our spiritual advancement. But what will bring about our spiritual advancement is to submissively hear the sound vibration of Srimad Bhagavatam. Submissively hear the sound vibration of Srimad Bhagavatam. Especially when it's described by the Lord himself. Now there's a famous verse in Bhagavad Gita, Vedais Char Savar Aham Eva Vidyo. Anybody know that verse? What part of Bhagavad Gita is it from? Do you know? Any of you Bhagavad Gita scholars here? What's that? You're close, a little higher than that. No one on this side? 15, yes, chapter 15, verse 15. She says, I am the source of the Vedas. So by listening to that transcendental sound vibration that Krishna himself spoke, we purify ourselves. Now, there's another point in this purport given by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he warns us that if one becomes attached to non-theistic ethical philosophies, that means like the teachings of the Buddhist or Ahimsa, no violence. Of course, nowadays the Buddhists, they don't really follow that so much. I can never figure that out, I'll be honest with you. I just spent some time in Tibet and in Nepal where there's lots of Buddhists, and lots of them eat meat. How are you a Buddhist and eat meat? I don't get that. Why did Buddha come? Who can tell me? To stop animal slaughter. So how can he be a Buddhist? Eat meat. Doesn't make sense. At any rate, so Bhaktisiddhanta says, you know, that if one becomes attracted to these types of philosophies, which glorify mundane principles of ahimsa, nonviolence, Such mundane faith in godless ethics becomes spiritual suicide. Spiritual suicide. So to restrict the senses, he says, by artificial austerities, or to undertake huge social arrangements to facilitate mass sense gratification, these are both godless attempts to regulate human society in a way that is completely artificial. If one neglects the natural leader of society, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, now, we don't have such a leader as that in our modern society. We end up with the fools and rascals we see in our current political system, but we won't go there. Bhaktisiddhanta says that when so-called moral philosophers spoil the opportunity of human life in the name of these mundane activities, such foolish persons commit the actual greatest violence against human society. What is the greatest benefit as devotees we can do for human society is to give Krishna consciousness. And the greatest violence against human society is to give some bogus idea, some mundane ethics instead. A devotee should not be disturbed by the word jugglery of those who are against devotional service. Lord Chaitanya says, this is a wonderful verse here that's quoted by Krishnadas Kaviraj, from Krishnadas Kaviraj. If you are indeed interested in logic and argument, kindly apply them to the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If you do so, you will find such mercy strikingly wonderful. I thought this was so nice. Kamatkara, strikingly wonderful. Now, if we look up the meaning of these two words, strikingly, it means attractive, impressive, noticeable, and producing a vivid impression. Sometimes you'll see something, and it'll really, it was just so amazing, right? A vivid impression. And then wonderful, excellent, marvelous, extremely fine, and something that arouses astonishment. If you go to Disneyland and you see one of those things, wow, it was so amazing. Yeah, not exactly like that. Something that arouses astonishment and produces a vivid impression. This is the teaching of Lord Chaitanya. This is how Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami describes strikingly wonderful. So, in the purport further, it's mentioned that a pure devotee of the Lord is aniketana, without a fixed residence. This doesn't mean that they necessarily don't have a fixed residence. What it means is that they neither accept the gross or the subtle body as the eternal residence. Since one's home and family are expansions of the body, material creations are also not to be considered one's residence. All right, hard ball. A Vaishnava should reject the gross sense gratification of living in the forest in the mode of goodness, of living in the city in the mode of passion, or living in the gambling house in the mode of ignorance. A devotee should thus understand that his eternal residence is fixed in the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is our eternal residence, the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, not any of the temporary natures, temporary identities, or temporary circumstances of this world. We may find ourselves in very nice circumstances or not so nice circumstances. The reality is that we should understand our true residence is those lotus feet of the Lord, and that's where we should be satisfied and happy. Now, on the subject of not having a permanent residence, by the crooked dealings of Kaikeyi, who, by the way, the description of Kaikeyi is that she was the most beautiful and the most cunning of the three wives of Dasarath. By her crooked dealings and the influence of Mantara, who is her maidservant, who is described by the following words: hunchbacked, ugly, and antagonistic in her appearance. You know how sometimes you see somebody and you just know right off, I'm not dealing with that person. Being in retail, sometimes I experience that. I'll see someone come away and you know right off, this is not going to be fun. So this is the kind of impression that Mantara gave. So Mantara is also described as an expert talker who who was very cunning in manipulating her way to get what she wants. So influencing Kaikeyi, she banished Ram to the forest with no permanent residence for 14 years. So, of course, we know the entire story there, that after Ram being banished to the forest and then the stealing of his wife Sita by that maha rascal Ravana, and then the great battle with the kingdom of Ravana, and, you know, that would be an entire class in and of itself just to describe the battle of Ram and Ravana. I mean, not even the whole Ramayana, but just to describe the battle, you could take one entire class. And the various fightings between the different forces and the striking down of Lakshman and Hanuman going and bringing the herbs to Sushena. What was that herb? Sanjeevani herb. It's found in the Himalayas and it gives life. You should get some of that herb, you know. Extremely drawless. And then, of course, Ravana's younger brother, Kumbhakarna. Anyone know what the name Kumbhakarna means? One who has ears like a pot. What the guy must have looked like, number one. And who gives their child, oh, my dear son, your name is Kumbhakarna, ears like a pot. I mean, I'm sure his mother must have loved him, but anyway, it mentions that actually, although Kumbhakarna was quite monstrous in size and had a monstrous appetite, which he satisfied by eating sages, he was actually a pretty nice guy. It describes he's actually had a good character, was really a nice person. He just happened to like to eat sages. So, of course, we know then the conclusion of the whole battle, Ram taking that arrow and piercing the heart of Ravana. And then that brought us to the point we are today of being able to celebrate Ram Vijayotsava, the victory festival of Lord Ram over Ravana, which, you know, in and of itself is just such a wonderful story. So, concluding today's class, these final words of the purport really are very nice to draw all this into perspective. The process of assimilating this transcendental knowledge is given in this handful of verses from the nine Yogendras to King Nimi and starts with Tasmat Gurum Papajeta. One is recommended to accept a bona fide spiritual master and serve him according to the directions of these verses. The essence of such instructions is that one should abandon the association of Mayavadi impersonalists, ritualistic fruitive workers, and those who are whimsically indifferent to the ultimate purpose of life, and instead one should devote himself to associating with the devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A falsely proud neophyte may imagine himself to be a great devotee of the Lord without taking the company of the Lord's followers. But, and this is the important point of this verse, but without such association, namely the association of the Lord's followers, it is not possible to become advanced in Krishna consciousness. Most of us have no trouble avoiding Mayavadis. That's not really such a big issue for us here in the West. Many of us do end up spending time with the other two classes described here, the fruitive workers and those who are whimsically indifferent to devotional service. Some of us have to spend a lot of time with these people. Srila Prabhupada therefore recommends that we should not take the association of such persons, but if we do have to mix with them, we should instead give our association to them. And then while executing the first portion of this instruction, serving a bona fide spiritual master, even though we may be associating with such persons, we will not be polluted by their association. Because we're not taking their association, we're giving our association. This is an important thing. But it has to be done in a mood of humility. People can tell the difference. It doesn't matter how dull and ignorant from the devotional side people are, anybody can spot ego. We call it false ego, they call it ego. Anybody can spot it. But we have to very sincerely put that aside, even in our dealings with non-devotees. Final note on this point. It says, one should devote himself to attaining to associating with the devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A falsely proud devotee may imagine himself a great devotee of the Lord without taking the company of the Lord's followers, but such association is not possible. But without such association, it is not possible to become advanced in Krishna consciousness. Now, I looked up this word that's key to this particular phrase here. One should devote themselves to such association. Now, the famous lexicologist Webster, he defines the word devote to concentrate on a particular pursuit as if having taken a vow, or to dedicate by a solemn or formal act. This exactly describes the mood by which we should regard associating with each other. Concentrated as if a particular pursuit having taken a vow, and to dedicate by a solemn or formal act. We should feel that's how we want to associate with our God brothers and God sisters, with our fellow devotees. This is a mood that we need to develop in regards to each other. Just like the morning program here, morning sangha, you know, the festivals we have. The different during the week, there's so many events at so many devotees' houses. One day of the week, this group reads Chaitanya Charitamrita. Another day of the group, this group reads Nectar Devotion. One night somebody talks about the Vaishnavacharyas. One night somebody talks about the teachings of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. All of these different types of sangha. And by taking this sangha seriously and devoting ourselves to that association, we will be saved from repeated birth and death. That's why we should take it very, very seriously. So that's the sum and substance of what I can gather from this particular verse today. And appreciate all of you letting me speak on it. Thank you. What's that? Madhvacharya mountain climbing. It's in the biographies on mountain climbing, wrestling, and swimming. Well, let me just say this. The first thing everybody asks when they hear about having gone to Mount Kailash is, why? I'll tell you why. Vaishnavanam yata sambhu. Our whole purpose as devotees, and the whole point made in this purport that I'm talking about, is that we should associate with senior devotees, that we should take the blessings of senior devotees. Who's the most senior? Who's the best devotee? The best Vaishnava? Lord Shiva. So that was our mood in going to Mount Kailash, to get the blessings of Lord Shiva. What are Lord Shiva's blessings? Well, some of his followers may pursue his blessings in the form of material rewards. But we know, Shriman Gopishwaram Vande, Shankaram Karanam Maya, Sarva Klesha Maya Deva, Vrindavan Patitam. That Lord Shiva is the gatekeeper. Lord Shiva gives Braj Bhakti. Lord Shiva gives the love for Vrindavan. So as the topmost Vaishnava, if one approaches him in that way, then one can expect to get his mercy, or hope to get his mercy, or pray to get his mercy. So with that mood, we, 13 of us, went to Mount Kailash. I will say this, it is the most physically difficult thing I've ever done in my entire life. And if anybody said to me, so should I do it, I would give one simple answer, no. It's that hard. It's 52 kilometers of rugged mountain terrain. And the amazing thing is, there's people doing Dandapat Parikrama of this. I mean, it's incredible, these local Tibetan people doing Dandapat Parikrama through the mountains, up the passes, over the rocks, down in the river, over the bridges. The second day, we go from 15,000 feet elevation to 18,600. 3,000 foot climb at about a 75 or 80 degree angle over the course of 5 hours. Those National Geographic things you see of them climbing Mount Everest where the guys are in the snow and they... they take 5 steps and then stop and breathe for 10. And then take 5 more. Well, take away the snow and that's exactly what it was like. And when we got to the top, instead of looking up at glacier snow-covered mountains, we were eye to eye with glacier snow-covered mountains. Now, the one thing I kept thinking as we were doing this, I'm looking up and I'm seeing this huge, beautiful mountain. And you never go on Mount Kailash. There's four traditions that hold Mount Kailash sacred. And none of the four will go on the mountain. Matter of fact, back in the early 1900s, the British government offered to fund one famous mountain climber, I forget his name, to ascend Mount Kailash. He refused. He said, I would be stepping on the souls of all of these people that hold this sacred. So nobody climbs it. So, but there's eight mountains, smaller mountains that surround it, and those are the ones you go around. So I kept looking at this. It's huge. It's beautiful to see. Snow covered with waterfalls frozen on the side of it. It's just incredible. And I kept looking and thinking, but this isn't where Lord Shiva lives, not according to Srimad Bhagavatam. Well, actually it is. It's exactly where Lord Shiva lives. It's just that I don't see it. It's just like when we go to Vrindavan. You see Lord Bazaar, or the Krishna Balaram Bazaar, and all the traffic, and the Delhi Wall is coming in and clumping things up on the weekends. But that's not Vrindavan. The other Vrindavan is there, we just don't see it. Premanjana Charita Bhakti Village. One day, maybe our eyes will be tinged with that salve of love of God, and we'll see the real thing. So I was keeping that in mind as we were going around doing all these difficulties. That really is Lord Shiva's abode. He really is there. And when you get to the top, that we were separated in groups because different people were going at different paces. Some of the devotees were on horses because they realized after the first day, I'm not going to make this. Some of the devotees were on horses. And some were a little slower. So myself and one of the devotees, Mahaban, had our own little group. We were going at our own pace. And I was a little bit ahead of him as we were going up this steep incline. And so I decided to sit down and rest for a while. I sat down on the edge of a rock and I noticed behind me the rock was very flat. I thought, okay. So I leaned back and it was almost just like a bed, a stone bed, but it was, horizontal off my feet. Oh God, it was so great. And in no time I dozed off. And I suddenly felt a hand shake me. I woke up and it was a local villager who said, do not sleep on the mountain. With this cold and this little oxygen, you will never wake up. So I didn't take breaks like that on the mountain anymore. And then once you get to the top, oh, and that was the other thing. Going up that day, we gave all of our little day packs because the yaks carried all of our goods. I mean, you've never quite experienced a brute animal until you've been close to a yak. These things are really in the mode of ignorance. And I'll tell you what, if I never drink another cup of yak tea or eat another piece of yak cheese in this life, it'll be too soon. And so at any rate, the yaks were carrying. So we had a little day pack we were carrying. But that day we did the ascent, there was no question of carrying a day pack. So the horses carried that. So, but of course I got separated from the horses. So, and then your day pack is your little snacky lunch. Piece of pita bread with some yak cheese, a slice of tomato, and an apple and a couple of cliff bars. I went to India with a suitcase filled with 145 cliff bars. That was my contribution, was to bring all the cliff bars. At any rate, so I got to the top and I realized, wait a minute, I don't have any food. It's in my pack, which is with the horse, which I'm not with. And I was like, God, I really could use some heat. I mean, And there was a family, and you saw this a lot, families, mom, dad, grandpa, three little kids sitting there. They had just ascended to the top, and they were all sitting there jolly eating, And as I walked by, waved to the kids waved back. And the father reached down in the middle of the pile of food there and gave me a big handful of dried fruits and nuts, apricots and raisins and walnuts. It was just what I needed. And thank Lord Shiva, continued on. As you start the descent down, now as much as you went up like that, what goes up has to go down, and it's a very slick, gravelly path down like that. And as you just get over the ridge of the top of the mountain there, there's Gaurikund, this beautiful emerald green lake at the base of Mount Kailash where Gauridevi Parvati takes her bath. So beautiful. It's too far down to walk, though. The very idea of taking five steps off to the side of, it's just like, no, I'm not doing it. But I did find a cave, on the way up, and I detoured over to this cave. And the cave was probably about the size of this. And I climbed in it, and there was a crystal clear river, a crystal clear little creek, stream running through the back of the cave under the rocks, and one little spot was open, and there was a slab there, and I thought, oh, in another life I could have lived here. At any rate, so we get down to the bottom, and then the horses and the people and everything get back together, and the axe and everything, and so you start walking again, because we have to make it to our camp for the night. And we start walking. And we continue walking. And we continue walking. And then the snow comes. 5 hours of blistering wind, snow in our faces. Sleety snow. Everything's wet. And you think, oh, that ridge there, that must be where our spot for the night is. So great. And you get to that, and oh, that ridge over there. Get to that one. Oh, that went on like this for 5 hours. So finally we got to our camp for the night. And don't be confused about what these, they call them guest retreats. It's about this long. It's a piece of sheet metal on four sides and a sheet metal roof and a divider in between the sheet metal, sheet metal divider in between the rooms. Five people to a room. One light bulb hanging from the middle of the ceiling that goes on at 9 o'clock at night and goes off at midnight. The bedding on the beds, we very carefully calculated that the last time it was washed was 1863. And we calculated that the floor was last swept in 1920, but a little more recent. And then the bathrooms. Yeah. We'll just leave it at that. Really primitive. You had a hole in the ground and a 20-gallon bucket of cold water with a scoop. And it was very cold. There was no heat. The only warm place was the kitchen where we were cooking. We had an excellent kitchen crew. Sukanta, one of the Russian devotees, is ex-Russian military. He was a cook in the military. And he's just wonderful rice and soup and chapatis. Sabji at night. And it's just really, really like our whole thing. And then every morning, you had granola and yakuti. And you mixed it together and ate it, because that's all there was. And we're assuming Shalagram accepted everything, because everything got offered to him. And then you would continue on. So it's 3.5 days around the whole place. And that last day is only a half day. And when you make that final curve and see the opening expanse of the plains between the two mountain ranges, and you realize there's the last place. Oh, you cannot describe the joy you feel in your heart. But it was a very wonderful experience. And then that last meal we had, everybody shared their realizations and appreciations, and there were a lot of tears and thank yous and, you know, deep emotional expressions in that. And it's all being produced in videos, which Ananta Vrindavan's working on. Will soon make it out to, Facebook and other internet outlets and all like that. But it was an amazing experience. I'm very happy to have had the darshan of Lord Shiva in his abode, even though I didn't see him. And I'm very grateful to have gotten his blessings, but I'll never do it again and wouldn't recommend it to anybody else. All right. Yes, right down there. Huh? Yak tea? It's made out of yak milk. Yeah. It's disgusting.